It's Access Utah. I'm Lee Austin, filling in for Tom Williams. You've packed away your summer clothes and perhaps those books you took on summer vacation. Now time to hone your fall reading list, and we'd like to offer some ideas. It's all about books, authors, and literature this hour. Our first guests represent three independent bookstores in Utah: Betsy Burton of the King's English Bookshop, Candace Needham from The Book Table, and Catherine Weller of Sam Weller's. Later in the program, we'll be joined by writer Lance Larson. He's Utah's new poet laureate.
Some minutes wobble, then rise, a homemade kite with a tail of torn pajamas. In some minutes you say, I do. In some you vow, in this life, I would never.
We'd also like to hear what's on your recommended reading list. Stay with us. The news is next.
Support for Access Utah comes from Crumb Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
Thanks for joining us for our Thursday edition of Access Utah. I'm Lee Austin, filling in for Tom Williams, who had to leave at the last minute, and so I'm very pleased to be invited in to take on one of our regular book programs where we talk about what people are reading, what's new for the season, what book specialists are recommending, and just kind of do a general survey. And we also invite you to call in with your recommendations. I know a lot of book clubs are underway now. Right in the office, someone informed me that their book group is meeting tonight, and we'd be interested in finding out what you're reading as well. Coming up later in the program, we're going to visit with the new poet laureate of the state of Utah, and that will give us a chance to meet Lance Larson, who just took over the post in May, and find out what he's reading and what his interests are. First off the bat, we want to introduce a longtime friend, Betsy Burton, from the King's English Bookshop in Salt Lake City. Betsy, it's fun to talk with you again.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
You know, we've done programs, you know, around the holiday season, books as gifts. I think we've done it in the summer. I don't know that we've ever done a fall book season program, so we'll see what direction that goes. And I think probably, if we have time, we can mention some good children's titles, but I think probably we're more oriented toward adult reading this time. Also, joining us by phone a little later in the program, once we can get through, we're getting a busy signal, Catherine Weller at Weller Books Works. And in studio, we have with us Kimberly Nelson from The Book Table in Logan. All three independent bookstores, and that's how we like to do it. And Kimberly, thank you for coming in.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Let me start out, Betsy. Is there such a thing as a fall book season? I know that, you know, in the film industry, there's summer blockbusters, and then there's some things that come out to time with Academy Awards, and they kind of position around which big movies are coming out. Is it that way in the publishing industry as well?
Oh, absolutely, and it's really all about the holidays. You know, the books that they're positioning to sell during the holidays, the very latest they come out is August, because they want them to still be on the shelves when people are shopping for holiday gifts. So, and actually this year is one of the best holiday seasons in memory. There are so many good books coming out by so many incredible authors. And then on top of that, so many new novels that are good that it's kind of mind-boggling.
Do they time the release so that they're not competing against certain big authors, assured bestsellers?
Yeah, I think for instance that August is a wonderful time for new novels that they think might hit big, and for what we call mid-list novels, you know, by authors like Ivan Doig, who people love but who don't necessarily make the bestseller list. And then as you get further into the season, like October is the and early November are the primo times for the big names like Ian McEwan, and so that's, it's sort of a game. It's like going to Las Vegas, the way they play this.
Kimberly Nelson, are you, it seems almost frightening to mention this, but gearing up for holiday book sales?
Yeah, we definitely are. We've been planning for already 2 months at least, planning what's going to go big and what we need to order in and making sure we're ready.
And you're finding a good selection as well?
Yep. There's plenty to choose from. There's a lot of good stuff this fall.
And I should mention the book table is a little different. You sell more than just books.
Yes, we're a huge department store. I know our name's a little misleading, but we have a huge music section, probably one of the biggest music departments in the Valley. We have an extensive scrapbooking. We have a huge toy department and all the books. And we're also opening up a Halloween costume and accessory department.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. But you brought with you books, and we'll get to those as well. We want to get to some recommendations. And let me now welcome Catherine Weller from Weller Book Works in Trolley Square. Catherine, oh, I got to lock in. Whoops. There we go. I'm a little out of practice, Catherine. I'm filling in for Tom Williams at the last minute.
Oh, good morning to you.
Yes, and thank you for joining us. We were just talking about, I didn't realize this when we set this up, but we're already talking about book buying for Christmas.
Oh, yes, and although we bought these lists, all of us quite a while ago, we're still at the very beginning of the season, as I heard Betsy mention as I was being brought into the loop. This is just an astonishing season all the way into late November and early December. I'm actually having a hard time keeping up with everything I want to read, which is a wonderful conundrum, really.
By the way, Betsy, I forgot to mention, congratulations. You just celebrated 35 years of business.
We did. It was fun. It really was fun. But it's sort of hard to believe.
Yeah.
A long time to have done one thing in your life.
And you had a big open house, and that was
we had a big open house, and you know, all the booksellers were here, and lots of people came, and a lot of people came who had been here at the very beginning, which was wonderful. It was a lot of fun.
And Catherine, how about Trolley Square? How's that going?
You know, it's going really pretty well. We are loving seeing some old faces that we haven't seen in a few years and a lot of new faces. It's really interesting what a change in location can do in terms of how you look at book selling. And it's really forced us to not rely on old formulas and freshen up our game a little bit, which is exciting and wonderful. We really like the space. It's enjoyable. People can park for a change. You know, it's a delight to be settled in again.
Well, let's get to some recommendations and some books specifically. But one more general question. Do any of the books that show up on the New York Times best-selling list also make it into your recommended list?
Absolutely. But we're the ones that put them on the New York Times bestseller list. I mean, classically, that's our job as independent booksellers. We find books, like The Dog Stars by Peter Heller, which is one of the ones I brought along. Independent booksellers were all over that book. Everybody loved it. And it did hit the New York Times based on our love for it, and he would tell you that.
Well, I'm guessing maybe not 50 Shades of Grey.
No, that didn't start with us. No, but Betsy's right. Oh, throughout history, so many books have. It is our job, and it's what we do best. So, you know, we sell the Times books too, all of us, but we sell those gems that always fly under the radar that should be on the Times list.
Well, let's start. Well, Betsy, let's start with you. A couple of fiction recommendations.
Okay. I'm going to start with The Dog Stars because I just loved it. And I had the good fortune, I was judging a contest, and I was reading some very bad first novels. This is the first novel. And I started reading The Dog Stars, and the hairs on the back of my neck literally stood up. I was so just immediately riveted. And it's set in the West. It's set in a airport in Colorado. Two men are guarding the perimeter, and we're not quite sure why. One of them obviously understands the wilderness, but the other obviously understands guns and killing. And you gradually learn that there's been a flu epidemic, which has wiped out most of the population. So this is a dystopian novel, but oddly, not a dark one. It's got lots of hope in it, and it's just a great read. It's about the relationship between these two men, and the one is a pilot, and he's getting a signal from somewhere out in Colorado. I think it's Grand Junction, and he keeps becoming more and more curious. There's a dog, one of the best dogs in literature is in this book, and there's a love story that's just kind of mind-bending. It's just a great book, and it's called The Dog Stars, and I would recommend buying this for everyone. Men, women, teenagers, it's just one of those books that everybody's going to love, and I think it's really one of the picks of the season.
And as you say, it's found its audience. As you say, it's found an audience, too.
Already has found an audience, already is on the long list for the New York Times, and it's only been out for, I don't know, 3 weeks maybe.
Yeah.
So it's going to have a great future. The other one that I'll talk about right off the bat is Ivan Doig's The Bartender's Tale. I'm very fond of Ivan Doig's books and always have been, but they can be a little bit uneven, and The Bartender's Tale is one of his very best. The main character is a young boy, Joe, who comes to live with his father. He'd been left by his father with an aunt who he didn't like, and he's come to live with his father, who is a bartender in a small town in Montana. And it's about the relationship between this gruff bartender and the boy, and there's a kind of a mystery about the past and what happened to the bartender and what his own history is, where his mother went, and a young adolescent, I won't say woman, but young adolescent girl is part of the story, and there's a kind of growing friendship between these two that is not quite a love story because they're too young, but it just sort of another book that just has everything, and Doig is just such a good storyteller. He just keeps you going the entire time. You can't put the book down. And so these two books are great reads, books that you could buy for just about anybody as a gift, and both books that once you start them, you don't want to quit reading.
Kimberly Nelson, I know, like me, you weren't aware you were going to do this interview until the very last minute, so you didn't have a lot of time, but it looks like you've got in a couple of different genres that you brought with me. Mention a couple of those.
Okay, I'll start with one of my favorites. This just came out a couple weeks ago. This is The Rent Collector by Cameron Wright, and when I first heard about it, I knew I was going to have to read it. This is set in a literal municipal waste dump in Cambodia. The dump's called Stung Michi, and it's based on a true story. This is fiction, but it's based on a true story of a young family. It's a mother, a father, and then they have a little son who's been sick the whole time. And it's just awesome to see how resilient these people are in the situation they live in. They did a documentary called River of Victory, I guess, and actually you can see about it at riverofvictory.com. There's a nice little trailer on there, and it gives you footage of the actual dump and these people that this book is based on, so it really brings the book to life. But when I read it, it just, I don't know, it brings a wider worldview, and it helps you. You just realize if they can do it there, I can do it here. I mean, it's really a great book. It'd be a great gift, and it's one of those that you just don't want to put down.
One other title you got?
Yeah, I'll mention The Timekeeper. This is by Mitch Albom. This is on the bestseller list. I'm pretty sure all of his end up being, but he's the one who wrote Five People You Meet in Heaven. This one's called The Timekeeper, and it's about a guy. It starts, you know, this prehistoric guy starts measuring time, and he's kind of obsessed with it. And so as a result, he becomes Father Time. And he has to listen to all the people through the ages, you know, begging for more time or wanting less time, and what he has to do as a result of that. And it's just a book about how we spend our time and the value of it, and how kind of in our culture we're a little too much, we emphasize it too much.
Nice, thank you. Mm-hmm. Catherine Weller, we've narrowed it down by four titles, but I'm sure you still have some more.
I do. Starting with fiction, I'm going to talk about one writer who is a new writer on the scene. Her name is Claire Vey Watkins, and her book actually came out last month. But this is such a remarkable book of short stories that it should have legs into the holiday season and is actually ideal for holiday giving because her writing is so astonishing. The book is called Battleborn, and Ms. Watkins is a Nevada native. All of her stories are set in Nevada, which refers to itself as the Battleborn State. Most of them are just stunning stories about the contemporary West. Everything from two young girls who decide to go joyriding in Torino and find themselves in some fairly terrible circumstances to a pair of young Italian hikers who bite off more than they can chew in the wilderness of Nevada, and bad things result there, too. Her characters are all so very powerful. They're all characters who are lost in one way or another and struggling to find their ways. And there are times when you wish they could just get a grip, and times when you're rooting for them, much like with real people you know. They're very realistic in their portrayals. And her portrayal of the modern American West is absolutely dead on. It's a wonderful book for those who like writing about the American West. It's called Battleborn, and it's by Claire V. Watkins. The other one is by an old name that hasn't been very much talked about in recent years, John Nichols, the man who wrote the Milagro Beanfield War. He has come out with a new novel called On Top of Spoon Mountain. It's delightful in the way that Milagro Beanfield War was. It's bittersweet and funny. Its pacing is just wonderful. It's the story of Jonathan Kepler, who is a man that wants to climb New Mexico's tallest peak, Spoon Mountain, before he dies, and he wants to take his kids along with him. It's a great tale about making amends, struggling to reconnect with both one's family and one's past, you know, as well as the environment in which one grew up, since he's become disconnected from all of those things and led a rather dissolute life in Hollywood. It is a delightful read, and it would be, I think, especially good for probably a certain age of men. I'm saying 30 to 50. Just ballparking it there. Because it hits very well some of those struggles that men have as they move on in life. But it really can be read by everybody. I'm not a 30 to 50-year-old male, and I loved it.
Yeah, and I just fall a little outside of that demographic as well, so on the long side of things. Well, how about a couple of nonfiction titles?
Sure. I want to start with a book that I'm actually not finished with. It's a 700-page book, and I
Whoa.
Just got it. But I've read several hundred pages, and it's by Andrew Solomon, who I think we all know from the Noonday Demon, which won, about depression, which won literally every literary award in the universe. I mean, he really did. It won, I think, 10 of them. And this is such an interesting book. It's called Far from the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. And he takes as a point of departure his own gayness and the way his parents, who were very, very liberal, nonetheless had a hard time dealing with it, looked at it as an illness. And he's making a distinction here between illness and identity. So he looks at gayness that way, but he also looks at you know, disabilities of all kinds that way. So, you know, I as the parent of a child with actually profound disabilities, was just fascinated with this. There's a whole chapter on transgender. It takes every form of difference that emerges from, you know, as children grow, and the way parents deal with it, and the struggle, the journey and the struggle that parents have to go from the place where they look at these differences as illnesses, and for truly good parents to get to the place where they love their children for who they are, regardless of the differences, so they're really loving them for their identity, for who they are. But then it isn't, of course, as simple as that, because some of these differences are illnesses as well as identity. So, for instance, my son has an intractable seizure condition that maybe an identity, you know, who he is as a child with special needs who is quite wonderful in the context of life. I mean, he gives life to everybody, but part of this is, in fact, an illness. So there's a kind of duality that we have to deal with. It's just fascinating, and I think it's a book that will be important for all parents to read, all people who are living different kinds of life, but also for all educators should read this, and doctors. I think this is a book that is going to have huge impact on our society, and it's called Far From the Tree. It's by Andrew Solomon. The other book that I wanted to mention that is nonfiction is When Women Were Birds, which isn't new, but will absolutely sell all the way through Christmas. It's by Terry Tempest Williams.
Oh, yeah,
pardon me?
Yes, we had her on. Tom interviewed her not long ago.
Oh, great.
On that book.
So I don't need to talk a lot about
right.
it, but I will say that it is one of her very best books and is moving in so many ways. These 53 pieces are just astonishing. Tell you different things than you thought you knew about her life, make you look at your own life in radically different ways. It really is just a miraculous book and a wonderful book to give to any woman of any age and also any man who, you know, loves to understand a woman's point of view of the world. So both these books are just incredible.
Kimberly Nelson, I have the advantage of visual cues here. I can actually see the books that you brought in. And we're kind of moving around genres here, but you brought in a cookbook, and I love those too.
Yeah, people that know me would totally laugh at this. But I looked through this book. I'm really not into cooking and cookbooks, but I think this book might switch me. This is called Savoring the Seasons with Our Best Bites, and I love it. Like, I read through... Well, I didn't read all of it, but I went through every page, and there's not weird stuff in here. Like, you can recognize all the ingredients, because that's the hard thing for me with cookbooks. I'm like, what the heck is that? But, you know, these are all familiar ingredients. There's a picture for every recipe. So that's wonderful. And they've got it divided up into sections. There's spring, summer, autumn, and winter. So it has all these really fun recipes that are appropriate for the season, but then it also has extra things, you know, like napkin folding or party ideas. I was just going to highlight two things here. One is this really awesome s'mores hot chocolate where they take the cup and they dip it in butter and then in graham crackers, and then you put the hot chocolate and marshmallows in it. And I'm like, okay, that's so cute. And then there's a Halloween section here, a whole Halloween party food. It has little mummy dogs as monster jaws made out of apples. There's little cheesy fingers. I mean, they're just adorable, and they look easy enough that even I could do it. So this is probably my favorite cookbook I've ever seen.
And the title again, an author?
It's called Savoring the Seasons with Our Best Bites. Yeah, it's really colorful. This would be a great gift for anyone. Yeah, I love it.
And then we'll go to Catherine Weller, and I'm a little out of practice. I don't know how to measure the time. We're moving quickly here, but we're talking now about a couple of nonfiction titles. Catherine?
Sure. I've actually got two pretty slim books here, but from some of the biggest thinkers and probably best essayists of the late last century and this century, Christopher Hitchens and Umberto Eco. I'll start with Hitchens. Christopher Hitchens is one of those authors who people either really love or they really hate, and sometimes they love and hate him at the same time. He is unsparing in his analysis. He is unsparing in his language. He is a take-no-prisoners kind of author, and his last book that he wrote as he was dying is called Mortality. One of the big questions that people had when Hitchens got cancer and began dying was whether he would renounce his very, very prominent atheism. And he wrote about that in the book and ended up talking about how whether he should take Pascal's wager and bet on God. And he concluded the negative. Even as people were telling him that God was punishing him for his terrible, sinful ways, He is a thoughtful writer, and as a thoughtful writer, his response to all of the people who told him he was being published by God was that, well, if God were really punishing me, I'm a writer. Wouldn't he have taken my hands first? But cancer did take his voice, which ended up being very, very difficult for Hitchens because he was such a gadfly, because he did love to talk so much. And he had a very sad and devastating part of his book about the cancer. And he said, what do I hope for? If not a cure, then a remission. And what do I want back? In the most beautiful apposition of the two simplest words in our language, the freedom of speech. It's a powerful book that forces us to look at what we take for granted in everyday life, like the ability to speak and the ability to express our thoughts freely. It is a slim book, but it's very powerful and well-written, as always, whether you do love or hate his conclusions. Yeah. It's called Mortality. The next one is by Umberto Eco, who is just the most amazing thinker. His book that came out last year, Prague Cemetery, is just coming out in paperback as his new book, Inventing the Enemy, a book of essays, is being issued in hardcover. And in this book, Eco really shines as a writer. Although he is an extremely intelligent and well-educated man, he writes about his topics very clearly and concisely. So he doesn't really leave people behind, despite the fact that his lens is fairly academic. And it's a wonderful, enjoyable book that sort of romps through topics, most notably the one that says if society doesn't have an enemy, it will need to create one. That's something that was dealt with in Prague Cemetery. He writes about beauty, as he has before, and the history of fire. He's got a couple of really interesting, funny works, one about how proverbs are dangerous and another one about Ulysses and fascist critics thereof. I'm already making it sound heavier than it is. It's accessible, and it will make you feel smart, and it will probably make you smarter when you read it. I think it would be a delightful book to get for the holidays, and it's one that I'm actually keeping on my shelf to read again.
If you joined us in progress, that's Catherine Weller of Weller Book Works at Trolley Square in Salt Lake City, Sam Weller's books, and Betsy Burton from the King's English Bookshop in Salt Lake City, just celebrated 35 years in business, and Kimberly Nelson with us from the Book Table in Logan. I've totally neglected to offer listeners a chance to call in with their own recommendations or maybe a question or a suggestion. We do have about 5 minutes remaining. You can reach us at 1-800-826-1495, 800-826-1495, and we can work in a couple of calls as well. Well, with a few minutes, books for kids. Do you have any thoughts? Let's do it in reverse order. Let's start with Catherine.
Oh, you caught me off guard. I just walked away from my desk since there's construction above it. My two favorite picture books that I've seen so far, and picture books is one of the areas where I'm kind of lagging right now. The first one is by Jan Klassen, and it's called I Want My Hat Back. Last year we saw the delightful Have You Seen My Hat, which was the story of a very sad bear trying to find his hat from a disingenuous bunny. This is sort of the other side of the tale. It has the same lovely spare drawings that have just the right amount of color, and it almost, in some ways, almost the exact opposite because it is a different telling. The other picture book that I've really loved is This Monster Needs a Haircut, which is so good in so many ways. It's a great October book, of course, because it deals with monsters, but it also deals with that very frightening, I think, at first time in a young kid's life when they go to get their haircut and how truly strange it can be. It is absolutely delightful in its illustrations, and we're having a hard time keeping it in stock here, so I guess the customers like it too.
Anything sitting on the bookshelves at the book table to recommend in that genre?
Yeah, I'll tell you, my favorite kids' book this last while is, I can't even remember the author, but the title is called I Don't Want to Be a Pea, and it's the cutest thing ever. There's a hippo, and its best friend is a little bird, and they're going to a costume party, and the hippo wants to be the princess and the pea, but the bird doesn't want to be the pea. And so they talk about all these, you know, the bird's like, no, let's be a mermaid. I'll be the mermaid, and you be my rock. And he's like, no, I don't want to be a rock. Anyway, it's really cute how they go back and forth trying out these different costume ideas, and then how they finally work it out. It's a really cute book and a great one for reading aloud.
Betsy?
Well, there's a book called Goldilocks and the Three Dinosaurs, which is definitely a turn on the Goldilocks tale. It's by Mo Willems. And there are three dinosaurs who actually are speaking quite loudly, letting Goldilocks, who's lurking outside, know that they're going away because they plan on trapping her. And they put out the porridge really with the intent of eating Goldilocks. So it's quite a great turn on the story. And Goldilocks happily does escape through the back door at the end. And the moral of the story is that you must always, her moral is if you ever find yourself in the wrong story, leave. And the dinosaur's moral is lock the back door. And then there's a book called Pirates at the Plate. It's got the most wonderful illustrations, just wonderful, vivid illustrations of cowboys and pirates engaged in a game of baseball. So we have Long John Silver against Wild Bill Hickok and so on. And page by page, it's quite an exciting baseball game. And then in the end, there's a call from mom to dinner, and this little boy is shown holding his toy pirate and his toy cowboy. And that was the genesis of the game. It's just a lovely book for, I won't say for boys, because I think girls like pirates and cowboys and baseball too.
Is this one genre where the e-reader book just isn't going to cut it?
Yeah, totally.
You know, the e-reader book is not going to cut it. It cuts it. It's part of the landscape now. But there are so many books that you really can't replicate, and you can't replicate the experience of reading a book anyway. And I think it's going to join the family of books as just one more piece. It's not going to take over the world of reading.
I was reminded of this when I did look at the New York Times bestseller list, and they now have categories of combined print and ebook and so forth. But in the always challenging and fun world of the independent bookstore, Betsy Burton, the e-reader, is not... Well, let's just get your view.
Well, I just think print books right now are, you know, print sales are up for independent bookstores across the country. I think that's kind of the proof of the pudding.
And Kimberly, same thing?
We've noticed, you know, some impact, but yeah, I don't think physical books are going to go anywhere. People really love to have something to hold on to, and especially in children's, for sure.
And I know one thing, Catherine, and this is kind of implied by the whole conversation we've had here, but one thing that that you and other independents do well is matching a reader with a title. You enjoy that kind of work.
Oh, it's the best part of our work. I think every bookseller would agree with me. That's where the real fun is in bookselling. And it is what we do best. It's something that is difficult to replicate online. As good as knowledge-based systems are, it's not the same because you don't have the back and forth and the very intricate process of refinement that happens when you can question and get answers from a live person. And the person who has actually read the books instead of looking at meta tags for them. So it's something that we, I think, will continue to be valued for. And thank heavens, because I'm not sure I'm good for anything else at this point. And it really is just one of the most delightful things to have customers come in and to talk books with them.
Well, thank you all for spending the first part of the program with us. Interesting titles. I've been taking notes here. I hope our listeners have as well. And if not, they can, I'm sure, call Catherine Weller at Weller Bookworks in Trolley Square in Salt Lake City. Betsy Burton at the King's English Bookstore in Salt Lake City. Again, congratulations on 35 years. And the book table in Logan, represented by Kimberly Nelson here with us as well. Thanks to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And stay tuned. We're going to be joined by the new Poet Laureate of Utah after a short break.
Support for Access Utah comes from the Utah Humanities Council, enriching cultural, intellectual, and civic life by providing opportunities for all Utahns to explore life's most engaging questions and the wonders of the human experience.
Utah Public Radio has a network of news correspondents that covers the state and the issues that matter to Utah. I'm Jennifer Pemberton, online news editor for UPR.org, and I love bringing our news stories to life on the web with pictures and video, in addition to familiar voices and engaging print. From the national parks of southern Utah to the streets of downtown Salt Lake, we cover all the great outdoors and the communities in between with all the technology available to us. That's what makes UPR your favorite public radio station for engaging all your senses in the stories of Utah.
Support for Utah Public Radio is provided by Science Unwrapped in USU's College of Science, tomorrow at 7 in the Eccles Science Learning Center. The free lecture, Lights, Canvas, Action, Science Captured in Art, is by USU professor and art historian Laura Gelfand. Information is at usu.edu/unwrapped.
We're going to finish out our conversation about books and literature now with Lance Larson, who is the new Poet Laureate of the state of Utah, the author of several poetry collections, recipient of a number of awards. His work has been published in many places, and he's also a professor of English at BYU. Lance Larson, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
I've had the pleasure of getting to know fairly well the three previous poet laureates. Of course, we started with David Lee, writer of the interesting genre of, he started out, he's moved on, but the pig poetry collections. Ken Brewer, the author here of a lot of wonderful work, and of course his affiliation at Utah State University. Catherine Coles, I've known for a long time at the University of Utah, and now you take over. How does it feel to be part of that group?
Very fortunate. It's a bit intimidating, of course. I knew all three, know all three. Of course, Ken passed away prematurely, didn't complete his tenure, but they're terrific advocates for the literary arts, and I feel very fortunate to be a part of that illustrious group.
And that is part of your charge during your 5 years as a Utah Poet Laureate, an advocate for literature generally, poetry specifically?
That's a good way to put it, yes. The Poet Laureate typically makes visits around the state and advocates for the arts, and more than that, celebrates them. And I suppose sets some sort of example in the best ways to integrate art into a life and into the classroom.
And to do that, do you have any specific plans yet? I know everyone who preceded you had their own kind of different take on how to get poetry and literature before audiences and promote Utah work in particular.
Right. I don't have my set program yet. I'm still a little early in the game. I want to make some of my visits, diagnose a little bit, figure out what will work best. I do plan to have a strong online dimension so that whatever project I do have can multiply out and be accessed by a wide number of people. Of course, I'll be teaming with the Utah Arts and Museums in promoting programs that are already successful, like Poetry Out Loud. That's not my program, but it's certainly something that I want to be a part of. That's the recitation program sponsored by the NEA.
But with the poet hat on in particular, I'm wondering, I just got off with three independent booksellers, and we talked about fiction, nonfiction, children's books, and shame on me, we didn't get to poetry.
Right.
And I don't know if that's because there's an assumption that outside of an academic setting or very specialized readers that it's going to be a hard sell.
Yeah, I suppose in some ways it is. Let me share an anecdote, which I hope will be taken the right way. A former mentor of mine, Richard Howard, Pulitzer Prize winner, was asked once, what should we do about promoting poetry? This was in April during Poetry Month, and he was a chancellor of the Academy of American Poets. And rather than spin some sort of elaborate project, he said, you know, poetry has always been a private pleasure. Let's just keep it a secret. Now, of course, that cuts against what the Poet Laureate does. But what I mean to suggest by that is that it is a rather rarefied art in some ways, and certainly my aim is to advocate and to promote it as much as possible. But it's not going to compete with romances. It's not going to compete with thrillers and so forth. So what my task is, I think what the task of all poets is to find a place for it in the everyday life, and also to try to find those readers who need poetry and want it, and make the best possible case for it.
Well, if you had been on in the earlier segment, I would have been asking for titles, suggested titles. You don't have any warning here, but could you suggest a couple of collections?
Well, of course, I always have poetry on the brain. No surprise there. I am teaching a poetry class right now, and we'll be reading Jackie Oshiro's book. It's not a brand new book. It came out last year, White Thorn.
Yes, a Salt Lake area writer.
Right. Yeah, she's a poet at the University of Utah, terrific poet, a friend of mine. We're also reading Mark Strand's selected poems. He'll be coming to do a reading at BYU. He'll be in the state. He's reading elsewhere. Former professor at the U, Pulitzer Prize winner, MacArthur author. So anyway, that'll be a lot of fun. Michael Souter up at Utah State has a book called House Under the Moon, which comes out on the 15th. So 2 days. I look forward to reading that.
Yes, all great poets. And without even any warning, you were prompted to mention three very good names. I was wondering, and I've actually haven't warned you about this either. I've got a piece of your poetry that you read for the Bite-Sized Poet of the Month project.
Right.
Tell me about that.
The
project, called, and then we'll get to the poem.
It's called Some Minutes. One of the things that I do intuitively, I think most poets do, is to read, and they gravitate toward poetry that they love, of course. So I read a poem by another poet titled Some People, and I loved the way that this poem repeated the words some people this, some people that. I loved the rhythms of it, where it went, the way that that repetition opened up the poem in surprising ways. So I tried my hand at a similar syntactic pattern, except rather than repeat people, I repeated minutes. So that's where that poem got started.
Let's listen, and then I'd like to follow up with, apparently this project is going to continue a bit longer, but let's listen to Lance Larson.
Some minutes. Some minutes pinch us in a crowd. Some cheer us up. Some dangle us from the golden gate, then, at the last instant, pull us to safety. Some minutes wobble, then rise, a homemade kite with a tail of torn pajamas. In some minutes you say, I do. In some you vow, in this life, I would never. Some teach us the difference between oh and oh. Some say, what's the use? We'll all get audited, whether by God or a flunky at the IRS. Minute one, you believe in Bigfoot. Minute two, you doubt your ability to boil water. Minute five, you put on a paper crown. Meanwhile, minutes three and four join other unskilled minutes to compose a weekend trapped inside a snowy misunderstanding called Montana. In some minutes, a blind man reads by the light of his wife's snore. In some, a tiny girl peeks into a birdbath to see if she still has a face. Some minutes count mistakes at a recital. Some dream in neon blue. Some keep vigil with the dying and write down every pause and sigh. Napoleon whispers, Josephine. Oscar Wilde says, either that wallpaper goes or I do. Anna Pavlova, ballerina, leans forward to squeeze your hand. Get my swan costume ready.
That's a lot of fun.
Thank you.
And that was written, which collection? Was that in one of the published collections?
Yes, that's in Backyard Alchemy.
And you have, is it out now from University of Tampa Press or forthcoming? Genius?
The newer one is forthcoming. The one that I just mentioned came out, I think, in 2009.
Yes. Tell me about the new collection.
Well, it's called Genius Loci, which is Latin for spirit of the place. And I continue writing poems that ask some of the same questions. I write about family, the suburban West, wild and domestic life, belief, the natural world, and ask questions. I'm always enticed by things that I don't have an answer to. And so this collection is an attempt to follow up some of those leads and see where they take me.
And with an occasional humorous touch?
I hope so, yes.
It was Catherine Coles, the past poet laureate, I believe, who initiated the Bite Size Poem Project, wherein various Utah poets were asked to share some work in a setting that was not too, I guess, difficult or overly challenging for the average listener or reader.
Right.
Is that going to continue?
Yes, we'll continue it. I think the plan, though, is to have other organizations take responsibility, in a sense. I don't think that it would serve the purposes of the Utah Arts Council to simply proliferate poets. So we're thinking of possibly having links to other poetry groups like the Poetry Society of Utah. We've even toyed with the idea of including perhaps high school students in some way, have a competition. I mean, these are preliminary discussions, but we like the idea of providing a platform. And I think the Utah Arts Council is, you know, a natural launching place for that.
I think the idea in part was that you do need to hear poetry read and not just seen in print in books?
Correct. Yes, I think something is lost. I like both traditions, actually, but if you can hear a poem, it pulls out certain meanings that the page might obscure.
Expand on that, and or give me an example.
Well, I suppose when you look at a poem on the page, you're looking at line breaks. You can pause at a certain place. You can go back. It really is a slow process, and I like the way that the page can multiply meanings. You have a line break, and you pause on a particular adjective, and the poem may be advocating one thing, and then the line break reverses that. So you pick up on a lot of that on the page, which you might not hear well, when someone's reading. On the other hand, poems are much warmer and human when you hear somebody reading them. And frankly, I kind of like, at a live reading, some of the insights and asides that you get from the poet, either before or after the poem. It takes it out of an abstract space and embodies it in, I guess, in a human space.
And it is, yeah, literally easier to hear the poet's voice once you have seen him or her read.
Correct. I think you're right on that. There have been some experimental poets whom I found intimidating in the past, but once I heard them read, they felt much warmer, and I actually warmed to the poems a great deal. So I think that's a great option.
You don't mean like a poetry slammer?
I wasn't thinking of that. I was actually thinking of John Ashbery, who is has been an avant-garde poet for the last 40 years. He did probably longer than that, actually. He did a reading at Westminster, and again, I was thinking of him sort of as the poster child of postmodernism. And some of the poems can come across as a bit obscure or cold, but when he read them as this grandfatherly man in his 70s. They just took on a different tone, and I admired them much more after that.
Well, how about various genres of poetry, some of the contemporary versions, the competitive poetry reading, poetry slams, other...
Yeah, the poetry slam is an interesting phenomenon. I like what it does in that it is one way of reaching new readers. And I guess I think of it as, again, this is probably inappropriate, a gateway drug for the literary arts and for literary poetry. Certainly, it adds an immediacy to poetry. And there are a lot of poets who got their start there who later found the subtleties of literary poetry on the page to be even more seductive, and they moved in that direction.
Are there any immediate forthcoming events that are scheduled that could be mentioned? I know the book festival is coming up in Salt Lake City at the City Library in a few weeks.
Right. They're great readers. You asked me to recommend particular books. What I would invite readers or listeners to do is look at the outline, the schedule, and see who's reading, and read some of the books of these visiting writers, and then go listen to them. I'll be reading there along with you know, some other poets in the state, which is a great opportunity to get to know your poet.
That's October. I don't have the dates in front of me. Again, I wasn't as prepared as I might have been as a last-minute fill-in host here. Do you know offhand?
Just October. I think there might be some lead-in events in September, but most of them will be in October. And there are also readings outside of the immediate Salt Lake area, which I think is really wise on the part of the organizers to take the writers to the communities rather than expect everybody to, you know, congregate around the Salt Lake Library, as great an icon as it is.
The Utah Humanities Council is the sponsoring agency, and I know they have a website with lots of information, and the calendar stuff and locations would be there as well.
Right.
And finally, right now you're working on a collection that was, it's fiction?
It's actually nonfiction.
Nonfiction,
personal essays.
Yes. Which won first place at the Utah Arts Council writing competition.
Right. I'm working on revising certain pieces and writing new ones and replacing those. I think that's how I usually work, is that I start with what I have and then try to improve. And, you know, each iteration gets closer to the final product. So I'm in that process of shifting things around. You know, some of the pieces have already been published, and there are some that I, you know, want to work on a little longer. But,
helpful to both poetry, writing nonfiction as well as nonfiction when you're working in poetry?
Yeah, for me it is. Sometimes what happens is if I have a project right before me, if it's poetry, say, I feel tempted to write the other thing. And then when I'm in the middle of nonfiction, I want to cheat and write poetry. So it gives me another game to play, I suppose. But nonfiction provides, in general, a larger canvas so that I end up addressing things that I probably would like to talk about but can't find a way to address in lyric poetry. So it's a way of broadening the canvas, let's say.
We'll leave it there. Lance Larson, our guest, is a professor of English at BYU, the author of a number of poetry collections coming out soon, Genius Loci, and prior to that, Backyard Alchemy. And he will be reading at the Utah Book Festival, Utah Humanities Council Book Festival, in a few weeks. That schedule is available online as well. Lance Larson, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for the invitation. It's been great.
And thanks for joining us on Access Utah. I'm Lee Austin, filling in today for Tom Williams. Good to have you with us. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, this is Blair Larson, host of Fresh Folk. On the show this week, I feature the inspiring songs of Laura Herskovich and the fierce and witty songs of Marion Call. I'll also play songs from new albums by Greg Laswell, Nancy Beaudet, and Trip McCool, to name just a few. Join me this Saturday at 8 p.m. for Fresh Folk on Utah Public Radio.
At Utah Public Radio, we discuss current events, social issues, gardening tips, politics, talk with local authors, and many other important Utah-related subjects. On Access Utah, an original program produced by Utah Public Radio. I'm Addison Pace, production intern for Access Utah. Join us weekday mornings 9 to 10, Utah Public Radio, Utah's favorite public radio station, for providing your access to things that matter in Utah.